Thank you all for coming. Tonight we're going to be discussing, as you all know, the topic, is there loyalty without nationalism? Celeste is going to lead us off, and then we have, I know a lot of people have prepared statements, so I'm very excited to see what you all have to say.
Okay. I think this question, it's very difficult to think about it without your own personal relationship to it getting in the way. It's either you have intense feelings about it or you don't. I happen to. I think you can have an uncomplicated relationship with this question if you're from Berlin or if you move there. I guess you probably also have complicated feelings about it. But if you're say a Jew who was raised in a Zionist family, then maybe you have to have complicated feelings about it. And I was and am. So I think that obviously I've been thinking about this question a lot and thinking about the responsibilities that I have to the communities that I'm a part of. I've been thinking about that a lot over the past 6 months. And I think the way that I've grappled with the different parts of my identity that place moral imperatives on me, that I feel the weight of them more now than I did 6 months ago, is that I have a responsibility to my community, but that responsibility is predicated on a respect that I feel for all human beings. And that sounds abstract and fluffy, but it's really not. If, like all of us, you've been watching human life be trivialized and desecrated over the past 6 months, and if my loyalty to my people is based first on a deep respect for human life, and I get at that respect through the human beings who I know best, I think that's if you kind of have an abstract respect for human beings, but you don't feel deeply tied to a community, I just have no idea what that means. And maybe it does mean something, but because I don't have any access to that relationship with human life, I can't imagine what that's like. So I think that my loyalty to my nation is always predicated on my loyalty to all people. And when I feel it, when I feel that tension, and there has to be tension, because I want to preface the one that I know best and the one that I love best, the one that raised me. There's a part of me that wants to do that. And then there's a part of me that recognizes that if a Jewish life matters more than a Palestinian life, that's undercutting the premise. It's trivializing people. And I only have a right to respect because of a common common dignity. So I think that's a lot to start us off.
So I predictably have entirely different concerns than Celeste. I have a kind of basic question to pose, which is, like, can I even consider myself to have a nation to be loyal or disloyal to? In my conversations with Celeste, as she's just articulated, this is an immense burden that I cannot identify a real feeling with, because I'm not sure, and this is something that you can all get into, I hope. I'm not sure that the United States really qualifies as a nation in this sense, that inspires loyalty in this sense, that inspires me to feel bound to it in this sense. I think I am a United States citizen. I think I am someone who admires what the United States is and something, someone who admires what the United States stands for. I'm someone who is indebted to the United States for many, many things. But I think there is something less familial about my relation to the United States as a whole than certainly anything Celeste just talked about. And I like that's the question I'm interested in. To what extent is this even a valid category for citizens of the United States of America? I would like you all to answer that for me. I'm going to pass to Carlo now.
I'm Carlo Massimo. There's a string of towns in the province of Lecce in the heel of Italy, and farther south in Calabria, where very old people speak Greek. They use the word anthropo for man instead of uomo, and gyneko for donna, or instead of donna for woman. 90 years ago, their own parents would have been beaten in school for using words like that. The logic of fascism, that's fascism with a capital F, the political program, not the epithet, held it unpatriotic not to speak anything but the national language. Today, the language is coming back with language courses and live-streamed events. The organizers are in their 20s and 30s, millennials who would otherwise have never spoken more than a word or two of this, their second native language. The question before us tonight is basically a plebiscite on nationalism, in favor or against. I'm in favor. I'm in favor in spite of fascism. I'm in favor out of admiration for the young people of Lecce and Castellano de Greci, who study a form of Greek incomprehensible in modern Athens, a language of no quantifiable utility, which cannot be exported and cannot get them jobs. I am in favor out of contempt for that segment of our generation to whom the nation is meaningless because geography is obsolete, to whom the texture of life, its literal landscapes, the soul of a place in the color of a voice or felt through the sole of your shoe must be flattened and digitized and color corrected to be real, who pile into fungible cities and eat increasingly indistinguishable food, whose work lives and love lives can be transacted from any couch in the Lower East Side or Camden Town, whose literature consists mostly of crisp white page, and for whom citizenship can be reduced to a passport and has never meant membership in a family. The well-to-do and homeless by choice, breathes there a man with a soul so dead. I'm in favor of nationalism because I'm in favor of place, of geography, of hard particularity. I'm in favor for the same reason that Pierpaolo Pasolini, filmmaker, poet, and prophet, was disgusted by the sight of men with long hair. Not because it was effeminate, but because it was smug and because it was small-hearted. The so-called citizens of the world are citizens of Amazon, eternal customers, and I've yet to meet a person curious about the world in its wild variety, in love with its distances and shapes, who did not feel attached to some piece of its soil as if through blood. I have a certain writer in mind that I shouldn't be picking on, whom I won't name, an American woman that lives in what they call a vibrant European city, whose language she has not yet bothered to learn.
Oh my God!
I wonder what she feels when she reads about the war in Ukraine, where an outmanned, outgunned army is held out for 2 years for love of country. 50,000 of them have probably died. What does she think they constitute? An imagined community? I don't want to end on that note. This is an argument in favor. Let's list what we're in favor for. In favor of accent, dialect, changes in language and face, a new ethic of heroism in politics, a new standard of patriotism, that one love his country as he would love a woman, for who she is and what she is in his arms, and not for any service she can offer him.
Ryan Ruby. I'll begin with a personal anecdote. We'll go back 21 years. 2003, I was having a conversation with my father, and the issue of the time, if you recall, in 2003, was the Iraq War. And my father was a supporter of same. And before the UN Security Council was a resolution about the Iraq War, which was struck down by Germany, France, Russia, and China, which would then lead on to the quote-unquote coalition of the willing. But in a other bit of cultural American ephemera, it would also lead to the reclassification of the French fry as the freedom fry. I don't know if you remember this particular incident. My father and I were debating this issue, and I asked him why he was supporting it, and ultimately the answer came down to he was an American and a patriot, and that's why he supported it. And therefore he despised and opposed the French who were against this particular resolution. And I asked my father, and this was, of course, he told me that that if I liked the French position so much, I should move to France, which I came close enough to doing in my life. But I asked him the following question. I said, "Well, Dad, if you were a French-born person, what would your position be on the matter?" And he said to me, "Well, in that case, I would probably be a French patriot, and I would be supporting diametrically opposed resolution to the one I am now supporting today." And I think that this gets to the heart of the question, the psychology of nationalism, which interests me greatly, which is that it seems to me to be a way of answering a fact about the human condition, which is that all human beings are contingently born to a particular place. It is not a matter of necessity that you were born the person you are with your particular national characteristics or your ancestral characteristics or your gender characteristics or your historical characteristics. You are thrown into the world in a particular body, in a particular time, in a particular place. And one way of answering, and this tends to make people, in my experience, I've seen, extremely uncomfortable, this contingency of being born. And one way of answering the question of turning that contingency into a necessity is nationalism, is a sense of identification with the place where you happen to have been born. The community that forms, of course, is determinative. It is. I am not here to deny that the simple fact of being born into a particular place leads you to have particular experiences, leads you to be educated in a certain way, leads you to form attachments, affinities, alliances, and identifications with that particular place. But of course, nowhere, and to Chris's point, least of all in the United States, which is an ersatz country, formed in modernity and is not really candidatory for nationhood in the same way as European states. It's a constitutional state rather than a nation state, although that proposition is currently being fought over in the United States and it's being attempted to be reconverted to a nation state with a great degree, in my opinion, of pathos for the people who are attempting to do that. You are loyalty to a set of experiences and persons and ideas, and indeed what that forms is an imagined community, an emphasis on imagined, imaginary, and fictional. The problem, of course, is not that the national identification, the problem is not that it's fictional. All forms of identification are fictional. The question is, what kind of fiction is it? And what kind of fiction does a person who lives by this in an ethos of relation to a particular space, to a particular history, endorse? At a minimum, and we can talk, probably will talk about later subsidiary questions about the relationship between that fiction and statehood, and that fiction and statehood, and of course, violence. But at a very minimum, the question of nationalism is a vast simplification of both the history of the particular place, which is really never, which is never really national in character. To use the example of Pasolini, Pasolini's first novels, of course, were written in a particular Roman dialect. And that was a sign of localism and identification with a small group of people which were under threat by the very existence of the Italian nation state as such. And of course, in this case, we have a linguistic difference, and the linguistic nation of Italy, the national language, is not the Roman dialect spoken, or Friulian, spoken by the characters of his early novels. So this is an example of the way nations provide a heuristic for identification, which is ultimately a simplification of your true self, namely all the various factors that comprise you as a person, and to pick one of them, and is specifically to pick one that is identified with a state, is, it seems to me, a pathos of simplification and a way of being in the world that is simpler and less complex than the actual history of both you, your relationship to your particular contingent circumstances, and even to the relationship of the place where you actually happen to be from. I'll just end there.
I'm Osita Wenevu. So I'm going to cheat here a little and speak not directly to the question, but instead to the anxiety that I think lies at the heart of the original prompt. At the heart of the question of whether there's loyalty without nationalism lies, I think, the idea that there might be something intrinsically unjust about holding one's own country, perhaps the United States, first in our hearts and minds, whether we choose to call that preference loyalty or nationalism or something else. Generally, I think there isn't. There are two relevant general ideas that I think most people here would agree with. The first is, Kamala Harris might put it, is that none of us fell out of a coconut tree. We exist in the context of all in which we live and what came before us. And the second is that being close to some people does not erase our obligations to others. If a total stranger collapses in front of you on the street, that person becomes an object of some moral concern, even if that person isn't a member of your family, a partner, or a friend. These are ideas I think most here would take for granted. But something strange happens to them when we consider our relationship to countries. Odd doubts start creeping in. First, those wary of ties to country tend to argue as though we could conceivably lift ourselves outside of our own context to look upon all humanity as a single undifferentiated mass and to afford an equal weight to all in our social and political thought. Normatively, I happen to believe it is true that we are all equal as human beings, irreducibly so, no matter where we happen to be and no matter what our circumstances are. But for better or for worse, the reality of human existence is that the people dearest to us tend to be the people nearest to us. The people and places we know and love best are the people and places we actually have real access to. Our interactions with them, political, social, and economic, shape the way we think, our latent preferences, and our explicit priorities. Even in those moments when we do look to and address ourselves to all humanity, we do so inescapably and again, for better or for worse, as members of particular societies. Nations, it is true, aren't etched into the natural landscape. The nation state is a relatively recent historical formulation, but the community is not. And the nation state has, if anything, radically broadened our spheres of concern, a form that binds us not just to those in our immediate surroundings, but that tells us we share common fundamental interest with people we don't know, living entirely different lives, perhaps thousands of miles away. This is, again, a fairly novel thing in the human experience. I think it's an innovation that has in many ways enlarged us. But our enlarged spheres of constant concern do not, and I'd argue cannot, encompass all of humanity. And the second odd assumption those critical of ties to country tend to make about why this ought to trouble us is that it may not be possible to identify and meet obligations we might have to others if we feel particularly close to some. It's not an assumption because this is something we all do in smaller ways each and every day. Again, we have friends, families, and partners. Nevertheless, I hope we all try to do right by people we know less well or not at all in ways ranging from basic courtesy to deep, wrenching personal sacrifice. It would be extraordinarily strange and untrue for someone to suggest that doing right in those ways required a sidelining of our close ties. Instead, we try to strike a balance. The work of striking that balance forms a substantial part of our moral thought and activity, as it should. When we think seriously about what we owe to others, I think it's often we find it easiest to solve or address problems that we know the most about. And this, too, applies at the scale of nations. It is right, I think, to want to lift up all of humanity. But I don't think there's anything especially wrong with wanting to start with the people right in front of you, the stranger right there collapsed in the street. It is surely the case that others elsewhere might be suffering more. I think we really should see to it that people the world over have bed nets and basic medication, clean water and clean elections. But durably alleviating suffering beyond the provision of the basics, granting real power and agency to people who don't have it, is incredibly difficult, and a task I think most easily pursued within the societies we know and are most familiar with, our own. And she said, too, that the people with the capacity to act at the scale of all humanity generally derive their resources from success within an economic system that constitutes part of the repression poor and marginalized people around the world are facing. With those resources, they additionally have the capacity to foist their own interests and priorities upon the world with less criticism and scrutiny than they deserve. For more on this theme, feel free to correspond with Sam Bankman-Fried in prison. None of this to say, obviously, is that there isn't much to mistrust or even revile in nationalism. There is. In fact, I think more broadly that we should be wary of actively constructing our politics around nearness. It is obviously possible for our spheres of concern to become too constrained, to slide from an immediate and I think often useful and defensible concern for those nearest to us to the idea that we owe the most to people who look and think and behave just like we do. Ultimately, I think we might even say that the point of society is to transcend overly tight connections, to combine in our variety to do large and important things. Still, I do think that we have to acknowledge and factor in nearness, even when we make appeals to hope to instantiate universal values. In fact, I think the ties we defend have to be reconcilable with and ultimately in service to universal values. If we are interested in the well-being of America and Americans, it ought to be because that there is a potential vision of what is right for America that aligns with what might be right for the world. And I think America actually has it easier than most nations in reconciling these levels of concern for two reasons. The first is that the United States remains, for the time being, at the center of global politics and the global economy. What we do and believe here does, as a material reality, significantly affect people across the globe. It is genuinely of broad and terrifying import. The second is that the United States was putatively founded upon universal ideals, and those ideals can be rhetorical and sociocultural resources for broadening, shaping, and when necessary, disciplining our national ambitions. We've abused our power terribly. We've visited untold suffering upon millions in the world. But as long as America remains an immaterial entity in the world, I think we ought to take a natural interest in the well-being of the American people, but also in the project of making America an actual credit to the world community. And this can be done, I think, with the right idea of what America is all about. As Richard Rorty wrote at the end of the last century, it was a given to many of the leaders, activists, and social reformers who've moved this country forward that the American project was fundamentally about perfecting democracy. Democracy not just as a form of government or a set of political values, but as a way of life and a way of being. Democracy as a faith that, in the words of John Dewey, in every individual there lives an infinite and universal possibility that justifies their control over their own existence and their own destiny. Democracy, Dewey said, is the form of society in which every man has a chance and knows that he has it, and we might add, a chance to which no possible limits can be put, a chance which is truly infinite, the chance to become a person. I myself believe, as maudlin and naive as it may seem, that America remains a place where the idea of a democratic society, radically conceived, might be enacted and perfected for the use of all the world. All that is grand and terrible in man, all the beautiful and terrifying possibilities of human experience, are either already indicated or contained in some form or fashion within our history. So I agree with Walt Whitman when he said, America is really the great test or trial case for all the problems and promises and speculations of humanity and of the past and present. It is a crucible and proving ground for fundamental questions about what it means to be human, and a place that, if we ever get our acts together, might model for the world a society that genuinely empowers and dignifies the individual, not just on pieces of parchment, but in material, lived reality. And I think America truly committed to doing so would be fully worthy of our affection and perhaps even our deep and abiding loyalty.
Lars Schoenander, nationalism is such a loaded word. When you think of nationalist, you think of ominous marches in the street and political parties whose main coverage in mainstream newspapers like the Financial Times tend to mention the idea that they should be banned. You think of discussions about the return to fascism world like commentators like Martin Wolf, or what happened recently with that big book on fascism that got reviewed in The New Yorker. But love of country doesn't have to be associated with those things, and it shouldn't be at all. I, through pure historical circumstance, have an interesting relationship to nationalism. Because of pure fate, pure fortune, I happen to be a citizen of 5 different countries. 2 in Europe, 2 in North America, and 1 in South America. When I pass through a passport terminal in Europe, my American passport goes away, and I switch out for a Swedish one. When I fly into Mexico City, I start speaking in halted Spanish, and then the passport lady gets a bit of surprise when she sees my passport has Mexican nationality listed on it. One doesn't need to be a hard nationalist to have a love or a fondness of country. While I might not be Mexican by blood, 3 generations of my family have lived in Mexico. I had the chance to see the old house of my great-grandparents in Polanco, and it was still the same it was in the 1950s, a bit more crowded. The Italians still send me election paperwork, even if it's horribly out of date, but I appreciate the effort they sent to me. They even sent me the paperwork of the province my grandfather, before he was born to Venezuela, moved to Venezuela, was born in. I appreciate them for that. I think of the past when, in the 19th century, nationalism was a liberal idea. You think of Greece, of Italy, of the Germans. Why did nationalism have to end up so horribly so long? Wrong. I know there are discussions about this. We could go into them in depth and probably devour an entire year's worth of conversation, but why can't we look to countries like Ukraine or Taiwan that seem to have their own view of the world that's particular yet open to other viewpoints? Why do we have to surrender the fight about nationalism to people who seem to be most ill-suited to wielding it?
My name is Matt Fleck. I would borrow some ideas from Carl Jaspers and suggest that we can be loyal to a country, or loyalty to a country can be implied through shared responsibility and guilt. So in the wake, or following World War II in 1945, Carl Jaspers held a series of lectures in Heidelberg, Germany, and tried to reckon with fellow intellectuals what the shared responsibility and the shared guilt of the German people looked like and how they could deal with it. He articulated four particular types of guilt in the situation. I think two of them are relevant to our discussion. That's a shared political guilt and a shared metaphysical guilt, he called them. In short, the shared political guilt is that how one is governed is the shared responsibility of everyone in a country. And the metaphysical guilt is that everyone is responsible for all the injustice in the world that you can help hinder. I think this gets at what Celeste was saying a little bit at the beginning as well. So I think when we think about nationalism, we can think about the shared responsibility we have to the other people in our country and to the other people in the world, and then that shared responsibility, shared guilt, is a basis for a loyalty to a specific place that is not based on pride or jingoism or something like that. I was sort of motivated to speak tonight because in the last few weeks, a little bit randomly, in a train, at a restaurant, I've overheard Americans talking about their plans to leave the country should something happen in November that they would not be fond of. And it made me think about what does it mean to be loyal to the United States? What is the duty of someone who despises Trump? Should Trump win the election? I would love to hear people's thoughts about that. And another thing that Jasper said is that people who have the power to affect more change have additional responsibility. And that as Americans, as some of you already alluded to, the United States has outsized power on the global scale, and that might imply that Americans have an outsized responsibility to shape the direction that our nation takes, considering our impact on global emissions or foreign policy. This country is going to play a decisive role in the next century. It's just, we have to deal with the fact. And so I'm wondering, my question for you all, and I guess my question for myself is, what is my responsibility to the United States, both to other people in the United States, other citizens of the United States and people who live here, and as a member of the United States to shape the path that our government takes moving forward, because it has such large implications for the world at large.
Hi, my name is Mimi Chang. I think I'd like to actually begin with a personal anecdote. I don't know how many of you have been to a U.S. Citizenship ceremony recently or ever. So I'm an immigrant. I got my U.S. citizenship when I was in college, when I was about 20. And I attended the ceremony with my mother. And we were in, I believe, a courthouse with many other people who were like me. And there was a moment in the ceremony in which you raise your hand and you have to sort of give up your allegiance to any, you know, principality, monarchy, theocracy, revolutionary government, et cetera, et cetera. And you also have to agree to bear arms on the part of the United States. And so this was a kind of thing that the USCIS officer would ask each person to repeat, sort of phrase by phrase. And I remember feeling I couldn't raise my hand. I stayed silent, and I felt this overwhelming sense of nausea, I think is perhaps the best kind of descriptor of it. And after the ceremony, I go up to the officer and I say, and I asked him, do you think everyone in the room knew what they were swearing allegiance to? And he said, no. So that's my anecdote. And now I'm going to sort of launch into the slightly more pedantic kind of historical perspective, which is, first, I mean, if we take the question very literally, loyalty has existed far before the existence of, let's say, the French Revolution, if that is where we want to place the kind of beginning of the modern nation state as we understand it. You know, loyalty exists to our friends, to our kin, to our guilds, to our unions, political allies, trading partners, et cetera, et cetera. Any form of human relation, complex human relation, there needs to be a kind of understanding of who is with me and who is outside of me and who is foreign and who is other, right? And to go along with that, I mean, I think if we think about the nation as actually a Western construct, that which derives from sort of secular Enlightenment ideals, then maybe it's time we kind of move past this unit of collective identification and think more imaginatively and think otherwise, right? And my last point, it's not an answer per se, but it's a kind of differentiation between two different kinds of loyalty. And this is not me speaking. This is a Chinese journalist and political dissident named Liu Bingyang. And he, in the late 1980s, wrote an essay called Another Kind of Loyalty. And actually, I believe his biography is called A Higher Form of Loyalty. So consult those as you wish. So he differentiates between two forms, right? The one is, you know, a kind of subservience, a kind of meekness, a kind of obeying orders, right, to whatever political sort of form in which you find yourself. And the second is really a loyalty to the ideas, to the ideals of your nation. And you can be loyal to the ideals of the nation, but not agree with the apparatus of the state, right? So I'm making a very clear differentiation here between nation and state. The state is the political entity. The nation is more a kind of collective cultural identification, and the nation is the kind of it is sort of buoyed by the practice of nationalism. And so I think, you know, I guess I just want to end by saying that, yes, you can be loyal to something like, you know, all men are created equal, liberté, égalité, fraternité, but you can be very critical of how that actually plays out, right? And I believe it was James Baldwin, please correct me if I'm wrong, who says, you know, I love America, and therefore it is my duty to critique it.
Arash Azizi. It is quite obvious that there exist and will always exist other loyalties other than nationalism. Even the most stereotypically nationalist person, whatever, whoever he or she may be, will clearly have other loyalties. Other loyalties to subnational peoplehoods that will always exist, loyalties to family, loyalties to transnational religious or political communities. So that much is taken for granted. So I'd like to perhaps slightly tweak the question and ask, what is the problem with not having loyalty to the nation state in the age that we live in, 2024? The problem is that we live in an age where, I'm sure we don't have anybody here born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Most of us were born, all of us, in fact, were born in the age of nation states, in an age in which this political identity, whether like it or not, was universalized through a series of a gory 20th century, which none of us would have liked to have occurred the way that it did, I think, uncontroversially speaking. And it's a reality that all the nation states, you know, pretty much all the nation states in 20th centuries had their borders and compositions set by the most terrible events that one could imagine, whether it is the Holocaust, the Armenian genocide, the population exchanges, the population transfers, that is as obvious and as familiar a story in the 20th century as it could be. Although I would remind us all that the non-national stories weren't exactly unicorns and roses either. So the problem is, what does it mean to say that we have no sense of loyalty or belonging to the political community to which we all belong? I would suggest, and what does it really mean, as the previous speaker also said, what does it really mean to go beyond the nation state? Of course, we can all want to go beyond the nation state, but what does that actually really mean? I understand that the power of language exists and we can say words, right? But what does it actually mean to transgress? And I'm not suggesting that it's actually meaningless. I think there can be meaningful political projects to go beyond it. After all, the European Union, as bonded as it is by the concept of nationality, it's the most dramatic overturning of it in many ways by some sense. It is perhaps rather ironic, though, that many of those who are very firmly anti-nationalist don't seem to be really a fan of the most successful confederal project of the last century, that is the European Union as well. So the question is, what does it mean to live in a state, vote in its elections, take part in its schools, pay its taxes, but not profess loyalty to it? And also, it should quite be obvious, I think, if you're having to have a serious discussion about patriotism. The most reductionist definition of patriotism wouldn't say that it means obeying your state and whatever that it does, right? I think, short of the Führer, that's not really suggested. In fact, I'd like to suggest that as much as we can hate nationalism for its gory history, as much as we suggest, as I like to suggest, about three times a day, I think about its potential in which Ottoman Empire and Austro-Hungarian Empire had transformed into different formations than the type of nation states that came to be. As much as we'd like to say, we'd like to think about those, we should also think about some, as said on some of the less read pages of that famous book by Benedict Anderson, of some of the progressive potentialities of this form of nation state. Its radical horizontality, for example. The most beautiful thing for me in a patriotic feeling is that everyone in this nation, no matter what they are, no matter how crazy they are, no matter how unacceptable they are, in the most accepted forms of civic progressive nationalism, and really I would argue, in fact, is embedded into it, these ideas are embedded into it, would it still have to be a part of a nation. You can have, your cousin can go crazy or communist or anarchist or fascist or whatever, but they will continue to remain as part of the nation. Is that exclusion would not be possible, that there is actually something radically horizontal about it. So I'd like to end by suggesting that as popular as it is, and we should also recognize this moment, if you right now go have dinner with a faculty of humanities and social sciences in most universities that would consider themselves progressives, somewhere between the hors d'oeuvre and the main course, the idea that nations are gross and their sort of thing will come up and will practically receive unthinking approval. So I'd like to suggest instead that if we do indeed want a more progressive world, if we do want more international and transnational solidarity, something that I firmly believe in myself, we should perhaps start by living through the horizontality of the nation and taking it seriously. That perhaps if we could identify with the political community that we have to be a part of, if we try to imagine it in the most egalitarian possible, both inside the nation, but also on a global level, and to take the sort of nations and the community of nations and their potential equality seriously, perhaps if we do that, that would be a easier way and a more supportable way of a more global future, as opposed to the far too easy, detached, transnational cosmopolitanism that exists of people who can afford it and who can perform it.
Hi, I'm Leon Wieseltier. I guess I should welcome you all to Liberties. I want to make three points. The first one is that There is no loyalty except to imperfect things. I've never heard of an object of loyalty that was perfect and was not worthy of criticism. And this is true of all loyalties. My son is imperfect, my lover is imperfect, my spouse is imperfect, my synagogue is very imperfect, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to get beyond this almost naive feeling like, oh my God, but it's not what it says it is, or it's not what it claims to be. Neither are we. Neither are we. And so the question of loyalties to things outside ourselves, larger than ourselves, it begins obviously with the recognition that criticism is an intrinsic part of loyalty, but there's a certain kind of grumpiness about imperfection that I detect and have for a long time that I think is silly. I think we just have to recognize that we're all talking about loves for imperfect objects. The second thing I wanted to say is that there are two distinctions that are at the background of many of the things that have been said here that I sort of wish we could retire. The first one is a distinction between the particular and the universal. There is no such thing as the pure particular, and there is no such thing as the pure universal. There are only compounds. There are only combinations of the two, and the ethical situation or the ethical judgment of an individual or a group has to be made in terms of the proportions in certain situations of the universal to the particular. I've never met a completely particular individual. If I did, I'm sure he or she would be a monster. I've met people in university life who think they are completely universal people, but that's a comic situation of little philosophical interest. None of us should ever depend for our safety and our good fortunes and those of our family and friends and what we care about on cosmopolitans, and none of us should ever depend for the same thing on tribalists. They are both completely unreliable because they are both trapped in their beloved self-descriptions. And we've got to move beyond this thing. The particular is the way the universal vindicates, it expresses itself, and the universal is the way the particular vindicates itself. And this is constant. And by the way, this is not just true of people. If you look at the works of certain architects, you can see that whereas there are universal modernist principles there, the rock that they use is from the region, and proudly so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other distinction that I would love to wave goodbye to is the distinction between sameness and difference. Because the relevant question for both of these terms is with respect to what? With respect to what? I mean, there is the cult of the other, which is people confer upon the other either glamour or horror, whether they think the other is a homeless person who will mystically redeem me from my shortcomings by allowing me to transcend myself and give him a quarter, right? Or whether the other is the person who is threatening everything I believe in and everything I've taught my children to believe in. We have to find some recognition of the compound nature of sameness and otherness. So, for example, to use an example from modern Jewish philosophy, surprise, Buber and that tradition go on and on about the other, but there was a German philosopher who preceded them that they slandered, whose name was Hermann Cohen, who was a Kantian rationalist, and his term for the other individual, for another individual, was not the other, but the Mitmensch, meaning the fellow man or the ethical obligation to give help to an other for Cohen is not that the other is the other and so enchants me with his otherness and gives me a chance to get out of my own limits, but that the other is just like me. And so I have to act on his or her behalf. So I think there has to be some, again, some sense that the sameness and difference, we should take we should lower the temperature on these terms. We should just lower the temperature on these terms. And the third point I wanted to make, and I'll be brief, is that, you know, you could ask the question a little differently, which is, how can you have loyalty with nationalism? That is to say, nationalism is the example we've chosen to talk about tonight, but every loyalty raises the question of its own limits. Every loyalty does. My own view is always been that conditional love is far superior to unconditional love, with the one important exception of parents and children. I think children have to know that the love is unconditional. But, you know, loyalty needs to be earned. It shouldn't just be assumed. You know, Neruda has a love poem in which he says, "I love you so much, I don't care what you're like." I would be insulted if a woman told me that. So there is some way in which every loyalty immediately, ipso facto, raises the question of its limits, and then you get into real torment. Then you get into real torment, except for people who have dissident envy and just can't wait to cast themselves in some heroic role of critique. But if you're intellectually and ethically responsible, you get into a situation of real torment, such as, I'm writing about this now because of what's happening in Israel and Gaza, in which you wonder what has to happen before you have to pull your loyalty. When is the loyalty no longer earned? And if the loyalty is true, this is an excruciating question. If the loyalty is not true and you're just a pundit, it's the stuff of today's column, but that's all. And so the thing that I need most to think about now is really, how do you think about the limits of a loyalty or a love that you take very seriously, that you take very seriously? And then when you think this way and you begin to imagine yourself finally into the place that certain great dissidents have found themselves, they all responded differently. You know, even mutating the mutanda, I don't think we're anywhere near that here, there. You know, I think, you know, Trump should be hit by a bus tomorrow, but I think we will survive even Trump. I think the U.S. Constitution is not that easy to destroy. But, you know, you can imagine the position of people who, I was going to say, even in the Third Reich, there were the internal emigres. There was Jaspers. There was Jaspers, who spent the whole war in Germany and never said Heil Hitler. There were other people like that. They were noble. Other people would have said they didn't do enough. There were interesting debates. So just what I want to end on is what vexes me the most about loyalties now is not how rich they are and how beautiful and how warm and toasty and so on, and don't we all have great cuisine, but when do you reach the point where your loyalty loses its integrity? And that means, and here I'll stop, that the loyalty is never the last word on itself. Because in order to judge a loyalty, if you judge a loyalty, you are judging it in terms that are greater than it. Moral terms or moral rubrics that are greater than it. And that is really murder. Okay, I'll stop there.
So I'm Sam Kimbrell, and I also want to speak about loyalty a little bit. It seems to me that it's hard to adjudicate political questions unless we're much more intimate. So I've been reading recently a number of the works of an American writer called Wallace Stegner, and he has one book that a novelist friend of mine glossed as unbelievably objectively boring in the plot and utterly scintillating in reading, which strikes me as true, called Crossing to Safety. And the basic story is of an academic couple who is married. They end up living this long life. The husband initially wants to be a poet. He comes from a wealthy family, but doesn't want to kind of fit the normal patterns of career. The wife comes from an elite East Coast family, places a lot of expectation on him, and gradually sort of you see him slip into despair through this kind of episode. He holds a great deal of loyalty for her throughout the entirety. He has this sense of care and concern, does not draw back, but it's precisely that sense of loyalty that gradually kind of pulls him into this life, that he becomes a shadow of himself. I think it's helpful to think a little bit about the stakes of the question that we're asking. Giving loyalty to something is a matter of putting ourselves on the line in some very basic sense. We are finite. We live for a short time. Our capacity to love certain things is limited in many ways. And so when we offer to be present to something, to make sacrifices for it, to continue to live our lives in harmony with it in some way, those are real questions with real stakes. And they don't start from a void. I don't think that children make an initial choice to be loyal to their families. And I'm not sure that we make an initial choice to be loyal to the places that we're born into. But I do think that there's a question of I think we do have to consider whether we give ourselves away cheaply in many, many cases. And the one of, I think, the great successes of nationalism has been the degree to which it articulates itself as immortal. It says it's an innate, natural concept that has always existed and from which we cannot escape. And I don't think that's right. And this is very much to the point that Leon was just making. The capacity to hold in reserve some kind of concern or care or love that's larger than simply the things that are being asked of us seems to me correct. How you actually make that choice in any particular moment is very, very challenging. And I don't think that you can ever achieve a kind of moral purity in those moments. It seems much more likely that the task is instead caring for specific things that are in front of us with a kind of intensity and fervor and the tempestuousness. And then as that builds, figuring out more and more carefully where our loyalty can be deserved.
The last couple of contributions have been edifying. What point that I want to make that I think is intention, I think, with them, is that often we, this is going to sound like something Sam just said, but it's actually not the same thing. We don't really get to pick always, and usually, you know, your family can piss you off a lot and you can decide that you don't want to have anything to do with them, but other people might have other ideas about whether or not you have anything to do with them. And I've been thinking about that a lot recently because I'm writing this biography of an artist who was born a Jew and he died a Jew, but he lived as much of his life as he could completely separate from his born community, and was really not interested at all in his Jewishness. And I've actually just started writing the part of the book today that is like giving models for how other Jewish artists who are in the same place as him. So this, I'm writing about Chaim Soutine, who was in Paris, and so was Marc Chagall at the same time. So this is 1939. And Soutine had gotten famous. He was actually as famous as Chagall, which might surprise you. not that I'm bitter, but he had gotten quite famous, and what he'd done with that was kind of like associate as much as he could with people who were not Jewish. I don't think that he was doing that on purpose. I think he just wanted to be able to paint whenever he damn well wanted to, and these people were letting him, but he was not interested in forming attachments to powerful Jews, which is a thing that sometimes other Jews do. I think of it, it's kind of like a safety mechanism. And Chagall certainly did do that. And he did that. I don't know if he did it for this reason, but those are the people who got him out. And Soutine didn't get out because he couldn't, because he didn't have those connections. And so, I mean, literally, like, I was going back and forth between Chagall sources and Soutine sources. Chagall was writing on behalf of his whole family to art dealers and wealthy Jews in New York, trying to get them to write to powerful people to get him the visas that he needed for his whole family. And can you get, you know, Peggy Guggenheim, how much money can she give? And every fancy Jew they could think of in America who could get him money, he was asking them for it. And Soutine was trying to figure out how he and his girlfriend, so this is like right after France has declared war on Germany and Russia, and he is a Russian-born citizen and his girlfriend is a German-born citizen. She fled Germany to get away from Hitler. He fled Russia to get away from pogroms. They both ended up here. Now they're both enemies of the state. And he's trying to figure out if he can get back into Paris from outside Paris because he needs his medicine from inside. And he's like now an enemy of the state and can't. That's like this month. And then in like 2 months, the problem will be getting out of the country entirely because he won't be an enemy of the state because he's a German citizen. He'll be an enemy of the state because he's a Jew. And he dies in the country and Chagall and his whole family make it out. And the difference between him dying in France and him escaping was the loyalty of his community. Whether or not they were loyal, like whether or not they were worthy of his loyalty, and I think he thought they weren't, it just feels like that's a question that he didn't, it was not the concern. And I know that I'm an American Jew. I'm like the most privileged kind of Jew that's ever existed. But I do think that nationalism for most people who need it, or maybe for all people who need it, it functions kind of like the way that identity politics functions for minorities and multi-ethnic societies. You need to band together with your own if you are small and weak, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to protect yourself. And you can say they don't deserve your loyalty, and that's well and good. But if you're going to be stripped of rights by other people who don't care whether or not you like them, simply by virtue of the fact that you are a part of them, like you have to contend with that. And I guess I don't know what the answer to that question is. I don't think there is one, but I think that it's not as simple as just deciding whether or not today they've been bad enough that they don't deserve your loyalty anymore. Or maybe you could say like, no, you should die because you should have nothing to do with those people. And like, if people are going to murder you because of your association with them, good. I think that's a pretty extreme thing to say. I've been told that recently, but I don't know anybody who would really do that. So Chris,
I don't think I have very much more to say. Obviously, not personally. What the distinction that I found most interesting was that the state precedes the nation state, but also that the nation precedes the state. These are not the same thing at all, and the particular way in which these have come down to us are not something that we're limited to.
The nation state, I think there is a bit of confusion about that, and this is also what in what you said earlier. The United States is a nation. You don't get to decide whether it's a nation or not, by which I mean that it's widely perceived as a nation. The term American nation wouldn't be considered an anomaly. If you ask someone, it is true that when you ask Americans where they're from in Berlin, they might say Long Beach. But you know, most people, if you ask them what's your nationality, they would say American. So it exists as this form of identity. And also, I think if from the perspective of 2024, we can talk about how nation and state historically have not matched and what that has meant. But from the perspective of 2024, the world in which we were born and we live is predicated on this idea that there is a community of nations and each has a nation, and the nation is linked to the state. And in fact, that's what I tried to say. The most important feature of it is the political community. So the idea that it's only a nation, if it's a Heimat or a folk or a, you know, that kind of stuff, doesn't fit what people actually mean when they say nation, right? And by people, I mean the widely perceived idea. Of course, there can be people who have exclusionary visions of nationalism, like there can be exclusionary visions of any other identity. But I think it's important to acknowledge that you are born into a political community that is bound by this idea of nation and states being conterminous.
I think that what we're getting at here, and certainly what Chris and Arash were getting at, that's important to make explicit, is that the quality, the moral quality and the political history of nation states will be determined by how the nation in the state is defined. And there are only two ways to define the nation, and that is homogeneously and heterogeneously. The classical European nationalism, which was taken over also by the Zionists and they reproduced it in Israel, was the nation was defined homogeneously. The idea was that there would be, every nation should have a state, every state should incarnate a nation, and ideally, we talked about this last night, ideally the political and cultural boundaries should coincide, but of course they never do. So you had what became known as the problem of minorities. That worked until the minorities reach a certain level, a certain magnitude, when the majority, so-called, panics, basically. But there is a whole other model, which I think this is the question that Europe is facing, and this is the question that India, by the way, is facing, which is to define the nation heterogeneously, that is to say, to think of the nation multi-ethnically. In Europe, there is no natural inherited understanding of multi-ethnicity. In the United States, multi-ethnicity has always been an accepted fact, sometimes honored more, sometimes honored less, certainly since the mid-20th century greatly honored, sometimes almost to a fault. And here, some of the problems that you have in the nation states with a so-called unitary fit, we don't experience those problems. The other country that didn't experience those problems until recently was India. And one way to understand what Modi is trying to do is to take back a multi-ethnic definition of the nation, a heterogeneous one, and replace it with a homogeneous one. Except, of course, that the size of the minority in India is stupendous. So there's going to be real trouble there. But certainly, my own view is that until we define the nation in nationalism and the nation in the nation state heterogeneously, and this is especially true in an era of huge global migrations, huge, you know, I don't know what the number is, but some years ago at one point there were 70 million people on the move at the same time. So as soon as we define the nation heterogeneously, some of the excruciating qualities of the nation state may disappear. Not all of them, but some of them might.
Thank you. Mana Afsari. I've been grateful for the contributions. I originally intended to respond to Arash, but I've been grateful for the contributions of Leon and of Celeste as well. I do think the sins of nationalism, as some people have pointed out, and I think rightly, are not unique to nationalism. They are, I think Leon was right to point out, part of all the imperfections of love and loyalty in the human life. The atavism, the violence, any of it is not unique to the nation state. You can find it in tribalism and imperialism and any number of political projects that have been attempted in the place of the nation. The nation, in a lot of ways, is perhaps a political golden mean between, say, tribalism and imperialism. For those that would critique it, I'd like to know what the alternative is in terms of being able to combine a sense of history and a sense of ideals in one political unit, a sense of representation too, as Celeste pointed out. Is there a better way to represent the interests of the individual person than, say, the nation? Are tribes better? Or is, you know, a world government going to really be more democratic? I would also point out that nationalism isn't, of course, as Carla pointed out, only represented by capital F fascism, or as Lars said, we shouldn't leave it to be defined by its worst examples. Nationalism is also the state of Iraq recently uncovering its archaeological treasures from thousands of years ago. Nationalism is also Iranians recently protesting to be able to celebrate their ancient holidays against restrictions around Ramadan. I think the nation and its loyalty, just like many other pre-political loyalties, not that the nation is entirely pre-political, but say love of a brother, love of a mother, they allow us to transcend any transitory political program that's trying to have us be loyal to it instead. I think you need a concrete loyalty, whatever that might be, and the critics of nationalism, I welcome you to tell us what that would be. Because if you just are an iconoclast and tear away all loyalties, that could be accused of being problematic or partial or prone to error. What you get is that we live in an eternal present where we're easily manipulable by any political program. I mean, many imperial projects have tried to erase particularity, and the nation has preserved them much better, especially in the case of minorities.
I noted your line about the group banding together in your discussion about nationalism, and this made me think of a small group of people and their attempts to try to suppress that. So I had the odd pleasure of meeting the entrepreneur / quote-unquote intellectual Balaji Suravansan, who came up with the idea of basically the network state, or using the internet to band together disparate groups of people into one group that would, say, pay taxes together. He got the idea originally from cryptocurrency and a very high-powered version of Albert Hirschman, where the stay and voice are basically wiped off, and the option is only exit. If you want to leave a community, exit. If you want to join a smaller community, exit further. It's simply just exiting on exiting on exiting. So when I had met him the first time, there was another speaker who was asking him a question where he simply asked Balaji Suravansan, "What community do you belong to?" And I remember the deep stuttering he had where he said, "I belong to Bitcoin and math." Yes, he actually said that. And we complain about the nation state, but I just worry sometimes that people's attempts to replace it are simply with people trying to get out of obligations. In the world of Balaji's exit, it's a world of a top 10% actively trying to dodge any obligations to the lower 90% so they can get to be up and beyond the rule of law and not have to deal with anybody else.
Just one very short point. Alistair McIntyre talks about how patriotism is a virtue, or perhaps the bedrock of virtues, because we experience the goods of the moral life not as abstract universals, but rather as particularized in the communities that we are part of. And so I think that this can offer part of the answer to Chris's initial question, which is, do I owe loyalty to the United States as a construction that, it doesn't really feel like a European homogenous nation, to use Leon's distinction. But I do think we owe loyalty to, the communities we grow up in. I do think we owe loyalty to our families, to our identities, to our, faiths, whether chosen or born into them. And eventually, the things that are within our circle of concern become constitutive of the nation that we experience. And I suspect that, trying to draw these lines too starkly will lead us into a, sort of linguistic confusion that, threatens our ability to be loyal.
Well, let me just start by saying, first of all, I grew up in one of the most sort of nationalistic regions in Europe, the Western Balkans. And this idea of blood and ethnicity and language and nation and flag was always sort of like pumped into us from early elementary school days, right? And so we didn't know any other way of how to relate to sort of like the world of the nation. So when I moved to the U.S. and sort of like I went to college here and I met people from all over the world, and that sense of sort of like belongingness sort of like diluted to an extent where At some point, I had no loyalties toward either my former country or the country that I adopted as my sort of like homeland, which is the U.S. So that helped me not only just become a sort of like a cosmopolitan person, but also really appreciate people who have a sense of identity. That is not so easy to just dismiss people who sort of like swear to you by whatever, you know, their roots or their flag or their nation. So it's, to me, it's always been in the last 20 years as a very nuanced, sort of like very complex approach. I subscribe to sort of the idea that we all share a humanity, obviously, but at the same time, I'm torn between dismissing someone who is genuinely expressing sort of like a nativist feeling and also a person who is just like, for a lack of better word, maybe some of us at least, not all of us, are throwing just performative acts on the scene. So for me, it's always been really this extremely complex question, and I always take it as a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, that's perfect. I would actually like to follow up on that and speak also to the distinction that Leon wanted to do away with, that between the particular and the universal. It is a simple fact of life in 2024 that there are nation states, and while those nation states may be of relatively recent vintage in human history, they're here. They form questions of identity. They form political questions. And by virtue of us being here today and born into this particular time, it is not simply that we can throw the nation state away for some putatively different ideal, although the nation state coexists with other things, such as empire, to use another example. And so the question is not between nation and some other unit. It is the question, since we are all in this particular historical moment, between the fact of the nation state and other facts. And among those other facts include, as Leon also mentioned, as you've mentioned, that there are movements of peoples across borders. There are persons with multiple passports, 5. There are immigrants to the United States. There are immigrants from the United States. And there are people who are born to a world in which their parents are of different nationalities. There are people who become, they become different nationalities in the course of their lifetime. And all of these are things in which your particular circumstances will lend you to. And the question then becomes not, well, how does the nation state accommodate all these things? It's the question of nationalism is somewhat different from this. And the question should, I think, be, right, so this gets to the question of the particular and the universal. Neither of these things are satisfied. None of these particular experiences of life are satisfied by the pure particularity or pure universality. And if the nation is a simple fact of the world, the question is whether it should be a weak or robust thing, right? And so in every existing nation state, there is this conflict between a weak nationalism and a robust nationalism. And robust nationalism tends to have problems with things that do in fact exist in the world, and attempts to solve those problems in a particular totalizing and often violent manner. And the problem is heterogeneity, right? Heterogeneity is every bit as much of a fact of current circumstances in life than the existence of a nation state. And so the question when we're talking about nationalism, it's not just loyalty to a particular set of circumstances to which you were born. It is a question of how does that loyalty affect you and other people within your community of space. The question is not whether you have this particular loyalty or no loyalty, it's which of the many loyalties that you do happen to have, that everybody has, multiple loyalties, which of those take precedence in any particular contingent time and space. And the problem with national loyalty is, of course, it makes certain claims which are ahistorical, namely its timeless character. It makes certain claims that are natural, in that being by virtue of being born into a particular space, that has an irrevocable or non-contestable relationship to you, even if you would like to reject that, right? And you might want to say, it's like, well, my participation in this community is contingent on my criticism of that. Well, this is a very American idea, which is, of course, based on a weaker notion of that. In Germany, for example, criticizing Germanness as such, right, makes no sense. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are many of things, and people do criticize German culture and German politics and so on and so forth. But the notion of Heimat is prevailing in that sense, and the notion that it is meant to deploy is to be beyond criticism, because it is a natural feature of the critic, which is how it's deployed. So I would say that when we're critiquing nationalism, we're not critiquing the existence of the nation state per se. We are critiquing a robust sense of its place in a hierarchy of loyalties, which is dangerous either conceptually or physically to other loyalties which any individual may elect to have.
I apologize to interrupt, but like it is how those
it's how those loyalties are enacted is the question at hand. It is not necessarily a question of like whether or not these are moral goods or whether or not they have ethical hierarchies. It is how they are enacted, and if they are enacted through violence, then suddenly the framework, the scaffolding for the whole building is specious. It becomes a way in which you can argue against it. It becomes an argument against itself. So if that's where you're, like the horizontalism you're sort of talking about, right? That doesn't really take into account the carceral state, for example. Right, like you can suggest that all these, like that it is in fact a net good that we have these frameworks and these loyalties and these like and these allegiances. But when those allegiances are built upon, or they require the servitude of a numberless multitude, you can't quite get outside of that box. Like you can't, like there's, it's a maze. And so unfortunately nationalism is like, as far as loyalty goes, like I think they're two different words. Like I don't necessarily believe in the, it, like I don't think the two are tethered or yoked in any significant way, really. It's a specious question, but
one way to think about it, I think, is that there is no principle of inclusion that isn't also a principle of exclusion. There is no such thing. Yeah. So the question then becomes...
I agree and I disagree.
Well,
right?
Do you know of a principle of inclusion that doesn't exclude anybody?
No, but do you know... But I guess the question back would be, there's no principle of inclusion that is not inherently exclusive. I mean, like it's inherently exclusive, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then do you think that nationalism like deserves loyalty?
I do, but I think it has to do with your ethical judgment of how a particular nationalism or nation state manages the exclusions that are implied by its definition of the nation.
These exclusions are presupposed by what? Exactly?
Well, they are presupposed by inherited tribal, collective, group definitions, but what militates against them. What militates against them is a word we haven't used yet tonight, which is rights. And rights attached to individual. Why are you skeptical? Are you skeptical of rights?
No, I'm not skeptical. I'm certainly not skeptical of rights.
That's good.
No, I'm not skeptical of rights. I'm
otherwise, give me back the pizza.
Yeah. I'm simply suggesting that it's not just it's not as simple as suggesting that we create a framework and we adhere to this framework as best as possible, and these people are excluded by virtue of only our limitations. It is not that these people are excluded by virtue of our limitations. They are excluded by our inherent failings.
Yeah, or by our inherited definition of our group.
Which are failings when they do tie to things like the carceral state.
Yes,
and or,
yes.
No, I know, no, but you're gonna hand wave that shit away.
I'm not hand waving any shit away.
It's unfortunate. Unfortunately, it does end up there. Like, almost always, the conversation becomes this. Yes, I agree that the particular is vindicated by the universal. I fundamentally agree. I do, but okay. I also believe that if we are going to suggest loyalty to a nation state, and Ryan made a really good point where the United States is a constitutional argument, which is now being turned to a nationalist argument, which is a different sort of construct. But if we are suggesting that you want loyalty for something that is inherently flawed, then what you are asking for is
a complicated life.
Not complicity. You're not asking me to be complicit, but you are asking me to witness, at the very least, the degradation or the dissolution of the other.
Well, no, loyalty is compatible with both complacence and critique.
Arash, go.
Nice volley. Look, to both of the points, here's why I disagree. Ryan, I have tried to say in a few of my interventions that what the modern sense of nation state is defined by is a horizontal political community that by definition includes membership, right? It's quite obvious that membership comes with having some say. I don't know what it means to say that if you live in Germany, you cannot criticize that.
Can you quickly define horizontal?
Horizontal means that everybody is everybody is a member of the nation. And even in the most draconian, let me answer that. By everybody, of course, I can define what I mean by everybody, right? But all the citizens of a nation state have some degree of equal membership in it, right? Of course, like all other.
Yeah, that's literally.
That's really
no, it's not false. It's not false. Well, no, it's not false at all. It's not false at all. You know, you can say, well, so let me finish so that we don't do so much back and forth. Let me just finish my point. Horizontality, I forgot, is the terms that Benedict Anderson uses, but it's if you just think, finish?
Okay, guys.
Does your conception of collectivity allows respecting the common rules we agreed upon at the beginning? So let me just finish my two sentences and then I'll pass it on. Look. It's quite obvious that a sense of horizontality is embedded in a nation. Of course, you live in a democratic nation state like Germany, in which literally your elected representatives get together and decide what being German is. If they want, in fact, if the people of Germany want to all get together and vote for it to change its name to Franconia, they can. Of course they can. Well, you can shake your head, but it's a fact that they can and that they have. And for your answer,
if you guys want to argue together, you can do it afterwards, but we can do it
this. I'll finish the sentence on pass on. And to Zane, what, and also to all of us, for us to remember, another important feature of the modern nation state is that in vast measure, and it's a very striking fact that we don't actually take into consideration,
in almost every society on Earth, vast majority of people who live in what we call a country are citizens of that nation state, right? Vast majority. Yes, United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and some others being the exceptions. So yes, it is true that we can talk about exclusions and all that, but the idea that everybody who lives there are citizens of the ancient state and belong in that political unit is now taken for granted. So much so that not having a statehood, getting a statehood from someone is considered an international crime. And the number of stateless people in the world is about 10 million people, right? So, and that's an important, these are actually important achievements, if you will, of the world order that we live in. It has nothing to do with carcerality. Okay, I'll stop here.
Seth, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Seth Newkirk. Difficult to know how to follow that up. I think something that is useful is... I lived abroad as a child. My father was a diplomat. And something that had always been useful for me was seeing America, the nation, as a collection of the different things that I loved to some extent. And I think that that's true for most nations, that at its best, it's a collection of all of the different loves, and at its worst, it's a collection of a few of them and maybe a repudiation of some, and then you have some struggle figuring out where your loyalty actually lies. But I think the usefulness of loyalty to nationalism is, in some respect, a loyalty to the things that you love that are expressed more widely, that are shared. The ways that my family loves one another are expressed to some extent, imperfectly, sure, by the American nation, and not fully. Perhaps they're better expressed by the state that I live in or the town that I live in. But to not be loyal to your nation, to not be loyal to nationalism, is in some respect to either say one of two things. It's either to say that the nation doesn't encompass, this nation in particular, doesn't encompass or respect all the things I love, or it's to be ungrateful to the things that does encompass all the things that you love. And I think there's some tension there, but it's a useful way of looking at the question of what do you have when there are a lot of people who aren't loyal to nationalism? Is the nation failed to encompass their love in some serious way, or are these ungrateful people? And I think this is where a lot of the arguments come, is that some people are accused of being ungrateful while the other people say, no, the nation hasn't encompassed my love.
That's it for tonight, folks. The next salon is going to be on May 18th, and the question is... should you like your friends? I swear to God, we picked it before.
I was hoping it would be about whether or not Beyonce is a country singer.
We'll file that one away.